This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ryan, and you are listening to The Vegan Report. Today, we discuss the topic of witchcraft with Dr. Coralie Wren, the author of the book The Vegan Witchcraft. Dr. Wren is an American sociologist specializing in animals and society, the animal rights movement, ecofeminism, and vegan studies. We talked about witches using human remains for spells, the witchy argument for veganism, how the animal movement fails women, the taboo of being a witch in society, what being spiritual means for an atheist, and much more. Get The Vegan Witchcraft now. It's a fascinating read. I highly recommend it. Link to order the book in the episode's notes. And share this episode with the witches and vegans you know. Let's spread Corey's message to the world. Leave a good review. And for more interesting conversations, make sure to follow the show. Thank you. Corey, welcome to The Vegan Report. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to talk about this topic and book.
Let me start with this kind of out there question. So I was born in North Africa.
Whoa.
Yes. And there, witchcraft has another meaning than in the West. And your book gave me an opportunity to think about the kind of witchcraft that is practiced in Asia, in the Middle East, in North Africa. And I feel like, you know, and you mentioned that in the book, you touch on that. I feel like in the West, whatever has to do with human beings, so using witchcraft with human parts or things of the sort, is very taboo, is not really practiced or promoted. But in, you know, Africa or in, you know, the country, like in my country where I was born, witchcraft practitioners do use, you know, human parts, will go in cemeteries and dig up corpses or things like that. Like, we keep our cemeteries guarded for that reason. And so, weirdly enough, there isn't that speciesism aspect to witchcraft in some other parts of the world. You know, yes, they will use animals, but also human beings. Of course, if you Google some of what I'm saying, you'll see cases of, you know, people getting abducted and having all sorts of bad things happening to them in the name of witchcraft. By the way, all of that is legal in those places. We'll talk about it later. But what do you make of that, difference of witchcraft in the West versus Africa and Middle East and so on?
Yeah, that is actually a very, very excellent point. I had a lot of difficulty when I was writing this book narrowing it down, because even if I were to look, say, in Ireland, Ireland does not even have a similar relationship to witchcraft that, say, in we do in Britain and the United States. So much of my book actually just focuses on the UK and the United States, because if we start to look global, witchcraft is, believe it or not, listeners, a global phenomenon, and it's still with us today. It's still actively practiced by people all over the world. And I wish that I could have more space, really, and bandwidth, if you will, to look into other parts of the world. This is a major aspect, I would say, of 21st century vegan feminist theory, which is the theory I use for this book, is that we need to start pushing back on white-centric approaches, Eurocentric approaches, because if we start expanding to looking at other ways of being, other ways of knowing, we can really expand our theory, and it can be a lot more fit for purpose, if you will. So I think if someone is out there, maybe it's you, but maybe it's one of our listeners who would like to do that research, I think there can be really some interesting challenges to the theory. Just for an example, this is not witchcraft, but one of the such a fascinating and very important example of how the same criticism works elsewhere in vegan feminism. And so you may be familiar with Carol Adams's theory, the sexual politics of meat. And the idea is that consuming meat is very much so an act of patriarchal dominance. Women's bodies are animalized, and they're also treated like meat, just like animals are. However, there's been criticism, or pushback rather, from a psychologist. Her name is Rama Ganesan. I think she's in Canada. I'm not quite sure. But she's done quite a lot of work on how that actually doesn't really make sense in the Hindu context, because actually meat eating there is much more, or the lack of meat eating there, it's much more of a caste issue, where the people who are Dalits, who are further down in the caste system, are more likely to be consuming flesh. And then the people who are higher up in the caste system are less likely to be consuming flesh. And yet it's a deeply patriarchal system. So how does that work with the very popular theory of Carol Adams, which is, we have to admit, in a Western European cultural context. So that is, I think, a great criticism you've raised, that if we can start to open up and expand to other parts of the world and how they interact with other animals and these different value systems, we can learn quite a lot. So yeah, that would be my thoughts on that. I don't know enough about it. I do know that it's widely practiced. I do know also that there are parts of Africa where certain non-human animals are in fact used and are targeted, because there has been some charity work in that region, or part of the world rather, to advocate for them. Yeah. What do you think, though?
Think about what exactly?
Well, what do you think? Like, how could maybe witchcraft from where you're from challenge? Because I think one of the premises of my book is the theology, if you will, of modern witchcraft is supposed to be about finding power in relationships with nature and fellow animals, the embodying the feminine power, all these things that have been kind of made evil or uncivilized or barbaric over the years through the church's efforts to stamp out paganism, or, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the Enlightenment period. All these things have kind of denigrated nature, animals, femininity, all these things. But witchcraft is basically saying, no, actually, let's reclaim that as a source of power, a birthright, if you will. Unfortunately, what happens in Western witchcraft in the UK, in the US at least, is that is a lot of talk. And when you actually look at the practices that they're engaging with, non-human animals are very much so objectified in a lot of ways. So if you're saying that in your part of the world, humans are used more in witchcraft and maybe not so much non-human animals, do you think maybe that could challenge witchcraft as maybe a new, do you think that there's a feminist element to it as well? Like, maybe you know more than I do about that part of the world. Is there a feminist element?
I'm not sure I know more than you do, because, you know, it's such a taboo in those societies. And not just that, it's illegal. You know, I came across a post on social media, and it was a document from the Iraqi government, and they were congratulating themselves for having arrested 100 witchcraft practitioners, and people were mocking that. You know, they were mocking that as if, you know, oh, they caught Harry Potter or something. But it's real, you know. It's they do, you know, practice witchcraft. You might not believe in that, but they do believe in it. And it is illegal, and the sentences for doing that are quite harsh. And the social taboo that is attached to you is also quite something. You know, you're marginalized in society. So it's quite, you know,
Sorry to interrupt, but what's it based on? Why is it illegal? What is the threat that these people are posing?
Religious reasons. So Muslim majority countries, you know, it's explicit, but also, you know, Christian majority countries in Africa, on the African continent, witchcraft is considered sinful, going against God.
In that way, it's not very different than from the way it's treated here in the UK. Well, has been anyway. Let's not forget that witchcraft was illegal in this country, in the where I'm recording from, the UK, until 1951. So it's, I mean, there was also penalties. I mean, maybe not the death penalty. The last person who was executed for witchcraft, I think, was in the 1700s here in the UK. But we do know that many, many people were executed in the US, the UK, Europe, and elsewhere. So I think it's a similar thing there that what are these folks, I guess the idea here is what are they representing then, and what can be gained then if we sort of sit with the people on the margins, if you will, because what are they representing? They're representing a challenge to the status quo, and I'm willing to bet they probably also, and I'm guessing, I don't really have a lot of experience in this, but I'm willing to bet that they're also a challenge to patriarchy. They're a challenge to this idea that nature is something to be controlled or even feared. And so witchcraft, at least as I understand it, is about reclaiming that as not sinful, not something to be afraid of, not something to be controlled. And it's not just nature is other, but nature is ourselves as well. And so especially people who have been marginalized, women, non-human animals, colonized people, etc., there's something to be gained there by reclaiming that and kind of doing away with these categories of who is civilized, who is not, who is pagan, who is not. But I'll also say that, like, even in the UK, we can't give a blanket, you know, everything is hunky-dory here. My partner's mother is a Jehovah's Witness, and she canceled Christmas this year because she thinks it's pagan and that would offend God. And so you better believe she doesn't know. She doesn't know about this book that I've written or any of the other witchcraft stuff that I do, because that would be the end of it, buddy. Like, it would be very awkward when I go to visit with her. So there's still persistence of that in the West as well. And we're not even getting into the United States, where it is such a hyper-Christian country that, you know, it's very scary not even to identify as a witch, but also, as I was talking to you earlier about, even identifying as an atheist can be very dangerous in the United States.
Yes, I want to discuss this. But first, you know, going back to that point of, you know, witchcraft in, outside of the West. You know, I'm also a native of North Africa. We're called the Emesichen, the Emesich people. And we always had a spirituality, kind of an animistic spirituality, which is deteriorating. And, you know, the question rises every time, you know, what is exactly witchcraft versus what is, you know, religion or spiritual practice, at least in those societies, you know? And, you know, all traditions from native people of the land, for instance, honoring a tree, is that witchcraft, or is that, you know, something religious and spiritual? And sometimes, you know, I see the mainstream religion getting mixed with the animist practices. And so, you know, you go and climb a mountain to go and see the tomb of a great seer, and you do it, you know, while reciting verses of the Quran. And you think, oh, well, that doesn't make sense much with, you know, the tenets of Islam, but you know, it went and mixed with the original practice of, you know, honoring the dead and your ancestors, which has been in place for maybe centuries, if not thousands of years. So what do you make of that, you know?
You're pointing out some really important conceptual issues here. Absolutely. Well, I think it just goes to show that any religious or spiritual practice is really what you make of it. And I think ultimately what, for me anyway, what would define something as religious is that it has to have this sort of supernatural element to it, a belief in a higher sort of cosmic order even. So you could really see witchcraft in all kinds of religions. If you look at Christianity, Judaism, there's a whole lot of that in there as well. So not just in Islam. And as you said, also in animist sort of belief systems. So for me, when I've tried to figure out, well, what actually is witchcraft? Witchcraft, for people who aren't aware, that the origin of the word, I believe it's an Anglo-Saxon origin, but basically it comes from the word Wicca, which basically means wise person, flexible, and also went on to be the word for like what we use for wicker, wicker chairs and things like that, flexible. So this idea that one is sort of flexible with nature, wise, and all this sort of thing. It's just a term. It's just a term we use in the West. But basically the idea being that you are, I would say, seeing power in nature. Whereas with a lot of these institutionalized religions, the idea is not to see power in nature, but see power in like this overarching godlike being, whichever religion we're talking about. And usually what we see there is a divorce from nature in some way. So religion being used then to uplift humanity from fellow animals and the environment more broadly. Witchcraft more contemporarily, at least in the West, is very hard to define because it's a nature-based religion. It's a nature-based spirituality, but some people also, as you mentioned, interweave other religions with that. So I know some people who identify as Christian, but also witches. There's some people like me, I identify as an atheist, but I also identify as a witch. I don't believe that there's some higher power governing the cosmos and all that. I just see magic in nature. And if I had to define witchcraft, then at least from a Western UK perspective, it tends to be, it's a nature-based spiritual practice. And it is very much so, unfortunately, or fortunately, depends on how you look at it, in relation to institutionalized religion. And therefore, it says, unlike institutionalized religions, you determine your spiritual practice. This is individually driven. Whatever satisfies you spiritually is witchcraft, versus all these doctrines and rules and tenets that you need to follow in other spiritual practices, institutionalized religions. We don't have that in witchcraft, which is something that I pick up towards the end of my book, actually, because it becomes quite difficult when we're looking at non-human animals. If we don't have any rules about what witchcraft is, it kind of, unfortunately, becomes a free-for-all, and that, well, anything goes, and it becomes quite hedonistic because it's in relation to institutionalized religions. It's about pleasure-seeking. It's about individual libertarianism, all these sorts of things, which can unfortunately then replicate some of the inequalities that institutionalized religions have imposed on society.
Yes, this is why I love your book so much. Again, the Vegan Witchcraft, go get it. It offers that framework, which clarifies a lot of things for me. It helped me think about this phenomenon, which is really pertinent. Okay, let's talk about the taboo associated with witchcraft. So let me tell you a story. I had a conversation recently with an animal advocate. She was invited to give a speech about her practice of witchcraft and her spirituality. And the problem was that she's a lawyer. And she thought, if I go and open up about this part of my life, clients will not take me seriously anymore. They won't hire me. And so it was a difficult decision for her to make, to be open about her spirituality and to be honest about who she is and how she is, a pagan and a witch and all of that. I was really saddened to see that. Because, what's the big deal? She's a lawyer. She's also witchcraft. So explain that to me.
What country is she living in?
The U.S.
Very good. Yes. It's a very, very Christian dominant country. And although the whole purpose of the United States is religious freedom, we are one of the least religiously free countries that I know of. Like we were talking before the recording about how I didn't mention this, but I have really been into witchcraft since I was a young teenager. And I think there's something quite telling that I got into witchcraft at about the same time that I got into animal rights. Became vegetarian at 13, and that's about the time I started really getting into witchcraft. But I kind of lost. I'd lost that when I got into the into university, and I think it's because I was picking up on as I was getting up, becoming a late teen, and then going into university. It's like this is not what serious grown-ups do, and it wasn't until I got really settled into my first academic position. And I was living alone at the time, and I could just do what I want when I got home, and no one was there to judge me. And so I started to dabble into it a little bit more, then moved to the UK. And all of a sudden, it was okay to talk about openly. But so I remember even in the US, like you had to be careful. I mentioned being an atheist and a lecture I was giving, which I thought was a totally normal thing to do. I'm not preaching atheism. I just mentioned it because we were talking about stigma and deviance in my sociology class. And it just happened to be a class that I was being observed on for one of my superiors. And they said, you can't talk about that. You got to leave that out. You can't talk about being an atheist. It's like, whoa, it was just one example. But the fact that she got so weirded out by that and like caught me on it, I was like, geez, there's actually quite a lot of research on atheism and stigma. And I've done research on that, by the way, in the vegan community. If people are interested, you can go find that. It's on my website. So we can't even talk about atheism, which is not believing in anything, really. We're surely going to have difficulty talking about witchcraft when we're talking about a serious, like we're talking about magic. We're talking about this whole history of religions trying to clamp down on witches and burning people and torturing people. So that's still around. Like that's still around. But when I came to the UK, there was a sort of relaxation about that. I think because paganism is still very much so incorporated into British culture. So I do think that her being American has a lot to do with it. But ultimately, what are you doing? Like, why does it matter that she's an American? Because what is she doing ultimately? She's challenging the status quo. Because Christianity in the United States, hopefully this doesn't offend anybody, but this is like my sociology speaking here. Christianity in the United States is not simply a belief system. It's a system of control. And many religions have operated in that way as systems of control. But in the United States, it's become so intertwined with nationalism. There's a reason why the Republicans and Donald Trump are always... Donald Trump came out with his own version of the Bible, for people who didn't know that, and it was charging like 80 quid for it. But it's wrapped up in power. And so to identify as a witch is, yeah, there's an element there. Maybe you're not being taken seriously. People think you're a bit kind of woo-woo and off the wall. Fine. But I think you're challenging power, and there's a deep stigma associated with that. And also, there could be serious professional consequences. I do worry, actually, thinking about it, like as part of just doing this book, but also I've been doing a lot of YouTube work with this book as well. If I wanted to apply in the United States to go back to the US to work, I'm not sure if anyone would want to hire me now because I'm open about it. But you'd really be surprised here in the UK how more open-minded people are about it.
Yes, definitely. I follow the work of, I think they're called the Church of Satan. they're great. They're hilarious at, you know, showing that double standard, how, you know, Christianity is put on a pedestal versus other religions. So, for instance, they will petition to have a Bahamut statue in the capital of a state where there is also, you know, the Ten Commandments. And they will say, you know, it's a public building. Why not represent every religion, including right. Satanism?
Right. Yeah, we also have to, like, I mean, I love the work that they do. It's brilliant. It just holds up a mirror, doesn't it? But I think we also need to be cognizant of the fact that, especially with witchcraft, this is one of the few... Yeah, one of the very few feminist-focused or feminine-focused religions, mainstream, if you will. And also, it is explicitly asking folks to recognize nature, our relationship to nature, find power and solidarity with nature and power and solidarity with fellow animals. That's quite, I mean, that challenges a system. And the state patriarchy... religion has worked for over 1,000 years to stamp out that solidarity, because the whole point is divide and conquer. There's a reason why there's so much emphasis on these rules and hierarchies in these religions. And that's the idea, is to separate us so that we can be more easily controlled. That's my sociological take anyway.
I'm realizing how much of an explosive combination this all is, you know. Even the animal advocate label is kind of a stigma that we have to worry about with authorities. Let's talk about feminism, because, you know, you contributed to the Science of Activism initiative with a podcast, an episode called Vegan Feminism in a Nutshell. So I guess my first question for you about that is, what is your diagnosis of, you know, the state of feminism in the animal advocate community, in the animal rights movement?
Not great. Not great. I've been doing this work since, so I first started Vegan Feminist Network, which is a website where I host a lot of my blogs, but blogs of other women and people on the margins, back in 2013. And I started that out of a lot of frustrated conversations with fellow activists. So at that time, I was in my 20s, and I was more engaged in the online activism community, which now I just don't have the patience for. A lot of that is because of sexism. But it was really irritating me how little people understood why gender mattered and why feminism could actually enlighten us and strengthen us in a lot of ways. And so I started Vegan Feminist Network, and I'm really sorry to say that here we are over 10 years later, and this is my new book project, by the way, which is what in that podcast I was summarizing. I'm really sorry to say that here we are over 10 years later, and I'm just still writing about these things. Just for instance, Vegan Campout. This is like one of my favorite things to pick on because it's just like so ridiculous. But Vegan Campout here in the UK, they have like this big lineup of people every year. They've been going on for like 10 years now. And every single year, it's just men at the top of the lineup. And you have to really squint to go find women down at the bottom somewhere. And a couple of years ago, I posted on Vegan Feminist Network about it, and the organizers came back and just like reamed me, basically letting me know that my feminist critique had no validity and I was making it up. And actually, women voted for no women to be here, so that makes it okay. And I was like, all right, well, whatever. Like these kind of nonsensical things. And then more recently this year, the Vegan Society, which has its own history with sexism, unfortunately, it's been trying to come back from that, and posted a short essay from this Taiwanese American person who I think was non-binary. And it was basically exploring feminism and how bioessentialism can teach us quite a lot in the animal rights movement about, you know, not equating worth with, you know, the body you were born in. And that person got so much vitriol in response to that, that the Vegan Society had to shut down the social media surrounding that post. So this is happening right now. So unfortunately, while I would advocate as a sociologist, we look at feminism and critical race theory and queer vegan theory as well, and theory from people who are doing disability studies. I think there's so much to be learned from that. It's a very divisive topic, and a lot of people are unconvinced that it's useful. Some people think that this is detracting from non-human animals, which I think is incorrect. But I think really at the heart of a lot of this is that people are just, unfortunately, just because you're vegan doesn't mean you aren't bigoted. So there's a lot of challenging work we need to do to get people to recognize, oh yeah, you know, women matter and people of color also matter and their causes matter. It's not just about non-human animals on their own, because the same systems that are shaping speciesism are also at work with these other human groups. So it's definitely an intersectional argument, but it's unfortunately not well received, if I may say so.
Yeah, I think people's first instinct is to think, well, the vegan community is mostly made up of women, so how can there be any sexism? And, you know, I understand that, you know, that reaction. But if I look at other situations, like I'm a fundraiser, my work, you know, is mostly dominated by women, you know, most fundraisers are women, but, you know, work where that is, you know, higher paid jobs in the fundraiser space are usually given to men. if you want to, you know, like admin work or more like stewardship with donors, that will be a task, you know, given to women. But if you want to acquire new donors and, you know, launch a campaign or something more ambitious, that will, you know, employers will favor men for that task. And so even if it's a woman-dominated profession, there is this level of bias.
Yes, that's actually a very good point. So there's, when we look at sexism in the animal rights movement, there's a variety of different ways it manifests. And yes, the gender pay gap is a major one. I've not looked into this recently, but some years back I went, and for people who are interested, if a charity is registered, they have to release every single year where the money goes for transparency. And so you can go and look, where's my money going? Where's the people's money going? And so you could actually see, I mean, I'm taking guesses here about male names and female names, but I think we can be reasonably accurate when I see higher salaries going to male names, that this is probably a sexist issue. And you're right. Also, we have research in social movement theory, not just in the animal rights movement, but in other movements where women are more likely to be relegated to the organizational stuff, the more drudgery of social movement mobilization, if you will. And what's unique, I think, to the animal rights movement is that, yes, 4 out of 5 people who are vegan are women. So you would think, well, women in the majority, women are all good to go. But actually what we have here is not just a female majority, but we also have a majority of people why do people come to the animal rights movement? Most of them are coming here because they're deeply empathetic and they are really, their hearts are out on their sleeve and they want to do what they can to help animals. That unfortunately creates a vulnerability and women are more easily preyed upon. It's basically a pool of highly empathetic, sensitive women. And so it's very easy, sadly, for abusive, predatory men, some narcissistic, abusive people as well, to come in and exploit women. And we do have a systemic problem with sexual harassment and worse. And that's been documented now. We have research to back that up. So that's not the kind of vegan world I'm advocating for. And the idea is, if we cannot get our own ship in order, how in the hell can we actually be thinking we can put together a prescription for change? We haven't even got our own stuff sorted out yet. Because if we still can't take women seriously and recognize women's personhood and right to bodily autonomy, what makes us think we can get that figured out with other animals? It's just, it seems quite silly. So we need to be thinking also about the way we organize our, like, as you said, how we organize our advocacy, our charity organization, even down to the grassroots level. I get very suspicious when we introduce a hierarchical means of organizing our movement, because invariably, this is a sociologist speaking here, invariably, when we introduce a rigid hierarchical system, in an organizational system, a hierarchy of command, whatever you want to call it, where power is concentrated at the top, we have the further down you go, more and more volunteer women who are not making money, who are doing the grunt work, who are not getting any remuneration for that, and who are more vulnerable to being exploited, sometimes even sexually. And then the higher up you go, it's going to be more men, not just more men, but more white men, more middle-class men, men from privileged backgrounds. And again, how can we then envision a society that prioritizes the well-being of everyone and recognizes the personhood of everyone and really truly believe have a system where we can realize equality, is what I'm trying to say. If in our own movement we're still relying on these old unequal systems that invite abuses of power and are not democratic in how we make decisions.
Very well said. And about your point on, you know, how this movement attracts empathetic people. You know, when I started working in the nonprofit world, I thought I was going to work with angels. But no, I discovered that lots of people will look for or seek proximity with vulnerable populations in order to predate on them. It is quite common in leadership. It's quite distressing, and we see the same thing in the animal movement. You know, we've all come across stories of shelters being managed by just the most cruel of people. And again, it's that. It's the fact that we put, you know, those predatory people in proximity with vulnerable populations.
Yeah. So the challenge then becomes, how do we make accountability and power sharing normative in our movement? Because basically what we're doing is replicating the same systems of oppression and inequality that we are all raised with, socialized with, in a very unequal, conflict-based society that we're, you know, existing in. But we need to, I think, foster an imagination for alternatives. And it's not easy. It takes a lot of hard work and a lot of hard critical thinking. And that's why, unfortunately, I think a lot of the times we just divert back to what we're familiar with, which, by the way, I think is also a major reason why we see a lot of sexist campaigning. The I'd rather go naked than stuff, which, although someone recently asked me, do we still do that? Yes, we still do that. I was on the high street here in Canterbury earlier this summer, and there was people in their underwear, women in their underwear, because that's supposed to make people think about, I don't know, the milk industry or something. So why are we doing that? It's just because in our mind, we live in a very sexist, misogynistic, sex-saturated society where we're used to, we don't even think about not doing it this way. We're used to seeing women in their underwear on full display in public spaces. Like, that's just a normal thing. That's what female bodies are for. Like, and it's like beyond the capacity of our imagination to think of other ways to use female bodied activists that's not going to reduce them down to sex objects, because that's what that is. It's not challenging anything. It's only sitting with the status quo. You're surrounded by women in your underwear and all over the public space and all these advertisements and programs and Netflix and whatever else. There's nothing radical here. So there's really an erosion, if you will, of the possibilities, like the imagination, the creative possibilities of the activist mind, I think has been really eroded just by being saturated in an oppressive society. So that's something I would like to see. I think feminism can offer that. If people... And incidentally, we're off the topic now, but in the Vegan Witchcraft book as well, I go into some of that where people are starting to use creativity. Creativity is thought to be fundamental to social justice work in feminism and witchcraft. How do we tap into that creativity to envision alternatives, not just replicate the status quo? Because especially when you're talking about in these nonprofit charities, risk reduction and predictability is the name of the game, because these are organizations that are working within a neoliberalized capitalist system. But that's not going to create social change. It's only working within the system and replicating the systems of inequality.
I agree with that. I always say, you know, not being creative is a luxury here in this movement. Quickly, to close this conversation on feminism in the animal space, what do you make of the fact that being vegan and caring for animals is in society mostly seen as something feminine? And yeah.
Sad. it's sad that we think, and I'm saying this having right now I'm working on revisions for that book on vegan feminism. And just last night I was working on the chapter on the first wave of vegan feminist activism of the 19th century. And even back then, the word they would use back then is sentimentalism. And even in the 19th century, this association was starting to become codified in the public imagination that women do the caring. Because especially, and this holds true today, especially we're now moving into this industrial revolutionary period where capitalism, rationality, efficiency, predictability, separation of mind and body, separation of civilization and nature, all these things are starting to now become normal and normative. And so women who were saying, hey, wait a minute, actually, this is not the human condition to turn off our emotions and to turn off our compassion for other beings. But they would be pushed back and say, well, you're just being sentimentalist. In fact, that was like the least of their worries. In worst cases, people like me who are so like life-driven, compassionate to help other animals in whatever way I can, and like, I mean, really out there with it, we'd be considered mentally ill. And still to this day, I think a lot of people do consider us mentally ill. But they actually had a diagnostic sort of category for it back in the 19th century, I think called like a zoophilia or something. But basically trying to stigmatize and pathologize what is a basic human functionality to see personhood in other animals and to want to help and to want to respect them and not hurt them. So this has a this idea that veganism or caring about animals is a thing for women actually goes back over well over 100 years. And it was because a lot of the women who were advocating for non-human animals and a lot of the early vegetarian advocates as well were also suffragettes, were also advocating for marriage rights for women. And by the way, it wasn't just women's rights. They were involved in abolitionism, anti-colonialism, prison reform, child trying to combat child abuse and public health, da-da-da-da-da. But because a lot of women were doing it even back then, there's this kind of sort of cultural legacy that this is something that women do. And that is really sad because we think about patriarchy here in the 21st century and all the toxic effects it has on men. So think about, like, it's not fair to penalize women and try to pathologize women and alienate women for caring. Like, that stinks, yes. But also, what impact is this having on men? We're having an emotional response to having a heart. Caring is something that has to be stamped down. And that happens because masculinity is defined in relation to femininity. So if that's what women do, men have to do the opposite, even no matter how irrational and silly and inhuman it is. But I think about this so-called male loneliness epidemic. Well, what is that about? It's about really embodying this, I don't need anyone, I'm an independent macho dude, and caring about other people is for girls. Well, now we have men who are isolated, and suicide rates for men are much higher. Depression rates are very difficult for men as well. Men who are in their 20s even, and 30s, are becoming isolated. So not caring, this idea of not caring, is actually toxic for men. And so I think that's a very important new realm for vegan feminism, is to reach out across the gender binary and normalize caring for men as well. I don't like, there's this idea, well, we can do the dude bro version of veganism for men. I think that only replicates toxic masculine norms. I think instead we need to start querying gender and do away with this idea that to be masculine is the opposite of feminine, because as long as we have that duality, we're always going to have a conflict system where women are going to be disadvantaged and men are going to get alienated in this non-caring, isolated, kind of anti-human way of existence.
And that's a cold place to be. Let's go back to your book and talk about, you know, the way that modern witches are perceiving animals, which is so interesting on so many levels. I guess as a segue, I could mention that, you know, I know that in my native culture, some ways of exploiting animals were, you know, attributed to, well, let's not go there. Let's, but yeah, so let's talk about, you know, how modern witches perceive, interact with the vegan movement and animals.
Very good question. But first off, I think for people listening, we should go there. We do need more multicultural analyses of these things. The more that, the stronger our theory is going to be. So I will validate you there. But as far as what do the modern witchcraft movement think about veganism? Not much. That is what infuriates me the most. Like, I think that was a main drive for me to write this book, is because I'm into it, I'm reading this stuff, and I'm having to skip through the books or skip through the videos on YouTube because they're saying offensive stuff about animals or objectifying animals. What is going on? Because the whole premise of modern witchcraft. So maybe I should clarify very quickly for people listening. I'm focusing just on the United Kingdom and the United States. Everywhere else in the world, we talked about this earlier, but they're infinitely variable. But in the United Kingdom, witchcraft is rooted in this longer pagan history. So it's sort of this long legacy that exists here. We've always kind of had paganism, okay? And it's nature-based, right? Even the word pagan simply means person who lived out in the country, person who lived out in nature. So it wasn't necessarily very feminist witchcraft in the UK when it was sort of regenerated in the 20th century. It was just more, it was nature-based. It wasn't very political. Whereas in the United States, witchcraft, as it reemerged, really did emerge out of the environmental movement and out of the feminist movement. And it's sort of, if you look at some of the writings of the main witches from the United States, like Starhawk, they'll actually say that I wasn't even really aware about the witchcraft revival in the UK. I just kind of intuitively knew that witch, to be a witch, is like the epitome of like the archetype of the evil woman. And we're in the depths of the feminist kind of fight against patriarchy. We're talking about the 1960s, 70s, 80s. Let's embody that ultimate evil symbol of woman and become that and actually create it and turn it from a point of stigma and marginalization into a point of power. So the American version of witchcraft has always been rooted in feminism and environmentalism. And in fact, later in the movement, by the 21st century for sure, the UK version of witchcraft, as they had reclaimed it, was now much more political as well. Now, okay, so I'll let the UK off the hook a little bit because they were really kind of trying to recreate folk histories. And Gerald Gardner, by the way, who invented Wicca in the early 20th century, he openly plagiarized from lots of different European folkways and a lot of Italian witchcraft and what he thought, what he interpreted out of anthropology here in the UK. It was an act of creation, fine. And it really wasn't about anything political, but in the UK, in the US, it certainly was. And if the idea was, let's get environmental, let's get feminist with it, you would think that the animal rights thing would be there. And this is something I explore in the third chapter of the book, because actually Starhawk, if I may take a leap here, I would say Starhawk is probably one of the most influential American witches of that time. She's still active today, by the way. But she was writing in the San Francisco Bay Area, in the Berkeley area. And she's writing in the 1970s and the early 80s. She's still working there today. And the heart of modern vegan feminism also comes out of that very same spot, the Berkeley space, the San Francisco Bay space. We're looking at Marty Keel, who I would consider really the mother of vegan feminist thought. We all think about Carol Adams, but Marty Keel is also doing this work, and she founded the organization Feminists for Animal Rights in Berkeley. And I know that she and Starhawk had to have had some kind of communication. They both had a chapter published in a book together on ecofeminism. I'm looking through Marty Keel's archives. She has mentions of Starhawk doing rituals at a feminist conference. So what really frustrates me is that Starhawk is in the midst of this vegan feminism, and she's not, it's no cross-pollination. And in fact, she makes all kinds of nonsense about how veganism is actually bad for the environment, which is ridiculous. But her whole point is that she's an ecofeminist and she wants to use witchcraft as a means of empowering marginalized communities and empowering nature. And yet she has this complete block when it comes to non-human animals. And I would say that that continues to be pretty normative of the witchcraft movement today. Although it's now much more political, it's still not very vegan. And I've had people email me and ask, like, what is a vegan witch, like a practical vegan witch book that you can recommend? And I don't have any that I can recommend. I'm working on a book like that myself because there aren't any.
Well, there's this one, the vegan witchcraft.
Well, that's not a practice, it's a theory book, right? But people want to, like, give me some spells, give me some rituals. Like, and that is, by the way, one of the reasons why I've started doing the YouTube channel. I'm now doing in-person community events as well. I just had a solstice ritual on Saturday here in Canterbury. I did one for Samhain and a neighboring city for an animal rights group back in October. Because I think it's one thing to just do the theory, but like we were talking about earlier, the creativity is important. How do we actually do and imagine different ways of being? So that's what I'm hoping to do in the future, is continue to do the in-person stuff, the YouTube stuff, and perhaps even write a book. I'm working on a book, actually, to guide people in everyday practice and encourage their own creative ritual making and spell work, if you will.
And thank you for doing that. You know, let me add this. I believe that spirituality is important for this movement, that it is lacking, that people needs it, because you know, they're suffering from, you know, burnouts and, you know, being close to this evil of animal exploitation. So they need some form of spirituality. I'm not going to say which form, you know. I'm personally a Buddhist. Some choose Christianity, others witchcraft. Why not? But let's promote it, that there are ways of coping with that pain. There are ways of interacting with the world that enriches your life experience. And also, you know, let's use witchcraft to be successful in this movement. Why not? You mentioned being, you know, the interaction with the link with the political sphere. I've come across so many stories of witches, you know, opposing Trump or opposing, you know, right-wing political movements or whatever. But also in my personal life, you would be surprised of how many business people, like very serious people, are also, you know, have their personal witch person, you know, who they go to do spells and stuff. And people laugh at that. But, you know, the serious people out there who are, you know, building this mask of seriousness and being official and all of that, they don't hesitate to use whatever means necessary to get what they want, including witchcraft. So why wouldn't we do the same? You know, let's do a big spell for for making this animal movement successful. What do we have to lose from, you know, entertaining that idea?
Yeah. Now, I have to say, my very first book is called Irrational Approach to Animal Rights, and I do tackle quite a lot of this spiritualistic stuff and religion. Like, I'll have a whole chapter on why I think religion is very problematic for shaping veganism. I've had to return to that in this new book, because obviously now I'm arguing a much different position. But I think there's a difference from I'm going to cast a spell to end speciesism versus I'm going to organize this ritual for fellow vegans to come together and imagine a possibility of something different. Or to take a moment to, the seasons are changing, let's ground ourselves in that and focus on some of the positive things. Or let's cast a spell to end speciesism, but really what we're doing is setting intention and thinking about how we can do real things in the real world beyond this kind of liminal space of the ritual to make that happen. So I think what you said earlier is so important. When I wrote that first book in 2016, I was in my 20s and still full of spitfire, But now I'm like in my 40s. And I always say this and it sounds really depressing. And it is. Almost every single night I go to bed, I have to actively train my brain not to start wandering off and thinking about some horrible video I saw or what's happening right now in the slaughterhouses or the bears who are being having bile extracted and like or the lobster in the tank that I saw the other. I have to actively stop doing that. And it gets harder and harder, I think, as you become an older vegan to manage that, because it accumulates. All these images accumulate. This knowledge accumulates. And it doesn't really go away. It builds up. And you can't just always be this receptacle. You need to have ways of letting it out and harnessing that energy and getting it. Go somewhere with it. And retrain ourselves, be that through meditation in a completely atheistic way, or be it through institutionalized religion, Christianity, whatever it may be. But for me, I'm advocating witchcraft as someone who's like on the fence here. Like, I was raised atheist, never been into the institutionalized stuff. But I also see a value in going out into nature and saying, it's winter solstice. It's very dark and that's very depressing, but the sun is returning and all the amazing symbolism with that. And so when I led the ritual last Saturday and we opened it up to the public, I didn't know who would come, and you'd just be surprised, people come. When I did the Samhain event back in October, I had a huge turnout and people were all open-minded because they're all hungry for that same thing, like how to manage these horrible negative feelings and the sense of helplessness. I can't fix that. I'm not going to be able to end speciesism, but what I can do is invite us to ground in nature for a minute and pay attention to the fact that the sun is still turning, the planets are still turning, the stars are still turning, we're still turning, the seasons are still turning. And we can connect to that and focus on that life regenerating. And actually just spending time in nature. We know that we have science on that, that's good for us. But it's also the community building, coming together in ritual and being creative. Like every time I do one, it's different. And it's always, it's very much so interactive. So people who come contribute in their own ways. And you just have a sense of, at the end of it. Right. So there, some of it I'm advocating, and we can do this as a sort of self-care, community self-care, if you will. But also we can use this more strategically. And this is what Starhawk has done. And if people are interested in how to use it more strategically, I would advocate going checking out some of her work, because she actually spells out how to do this. But we can actually use it to organize campaigns. Because one of the things is that when you get together for, say, an activist campaign, it may not be successful. And you may go home and think, well, I just wasted 2 hours. But there's other things going on there, isn't there? Like, you got out in community, you're interacting with people, you're getting to know, you're bonding with other activists, you're making yourself feel better. Because really, when you go out into a protest, for instance, isn't that a sort of ritual? You're not going to stop that incident, that oppression from happening, but it's a ritual in a way. But what if we can just add to that then and tinker with it so that we are being more conscious of it? And we're able to structure it a little bit more to where we manage people's energy and emotions in a more compassionate way. And how do we do that? There's infinite ways to do it. And I'm hoping to explore that more through doing the in-person stuff and the book that I hope to do one day in the future.
Yes, that's beautifully said. Let me continue on, you know, the non-vegan witches out there. What is their reaction when they're confronted with what you're saying, you know, that they should consider veganism and animal rights more seriously?
You know, I've not really had much interaction with them. The only witches I've really interacted with are ones I know in real life. And for the most part, they're already either vegan or vegan leaning. I'm trying to think. Well, I mentioned this to you before we started recording, but when one of the reviewers for this book, I'm pretty sure, was chosen because she was expert in witchcraft theory, but not a vegan, because the response I got from that was actually, I won't have time to pull it up now, but it's so funny that I sent it to all my friends, because it was like one of the most nastiest reviews, responses to my work I've ever received. And I knew what it was. It's because I'm actually holding up a mirror to this person. Like, here's the theory that you're promoting. And actually, it falls completely flat because the way we're treating non-human animals does not mesh up with this approach to witchcraft. It just doesn't. And so I was accused of just being like having a diatribe and thinking I'm going to become some great witchcraft guru and start a new movement. And it's like, well, maybe I will. But really, they were trying to dismiss me. And it was basically, they were trying to say that I was deeply biased and da-da-da. Well, yeah, I'm biased. I'm a vegan. I'm advocating for animals. And it really gets on my nerves when people accuse me of being biased. Like, I've never said I wasn't vegan. Like, the book is called Vegan Witch, for Pete's sake. The whole point is to come at it from a vegan standpoint. But almost every time I do anything on veganism or animal rights in a non-vegan space, I'm always told I have to explain why this is relevant or why it's not biased, da-da-da-da-da. I would like to think that if you were writing on racism or feminism in non-feminist or non-racist spaces, you wouldn't have to stop and say, well, why this is why it's not biased or blah, blah, blah. Like, but because it's about animals, I'm accused of being biased. But I can talk all day long about feminism, and that's just considered, okay, a perfectly legitimate critique, at least in these, you know, academic spaces. So, yeah, I don't know. I haven't really got much feedback on that. I've only gotten positive feedback thus far, which has been very, very encouraging. I'm sure that there are negative responses, but they're just keeping it to themselves. So thank you for that.
Yes, I always say I've had these conversations too many times for my taste. But I always say this podcast, you know, is not objective. I'm independent, but I'm not objective, and I'm not trying to be, because it's impossible. I come with my biases. I'm transparent about them, but yeah, I'm not aiming at that. I'm aiming to be independent. That's it.
Yeah.
Yes. One more point about those witches. You know, why do they consider using, you know, humans as taboo. We talked about that in the beginning. It's something a bit morbid, so sorry for bringing this up again. But I feel, you know, it's a conversation starter for, you know, doing animal advocacy work with them. Like, you're not using humans. Why is that? Explain. There's a difference. But what about, you know, animals then?
Yeah, so that is a very, very good observation. I did pick up on that quite a bit. And by the way, I didn't mention like what this book is kind of, what the methodology was, but I wanted to start from the beginning. So I just went to find every single major contribution to witchcraft, modern witchcraft theory that I could on the contemporary. By the way, I don't really talk too much in the book about the witchcraft trials and medieval times and stuff. It's just too much to take on. But looking at the publications from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, et cetera. So I went straight to the source, basically, to see what are people saying. And this is one of the things I did, in fact, see, is that they would make all these claims about practicing respect for others, but it would not go to other animals. So one of the things that the modern witchcraft movement did in order to destigmatize itself and to legitimate itself was to focus on healing. So it's quite a lot of healing work. So they, especially in the UK, after it was decriminalized, witchcraft was decriminalized, there was a lot of active work for the major witchcraft leaders to, in the media, to basically say, we don't do black magic, we don't do dark magic, we don't sacrifice animals, we don't eat little children, we are healers, we're community healers, you know, which is kind of what I'm doing with vegan witchcraft. I'm trying to do like healing work in the vegan community. Okay, fine. But when we look into actually the practices that folks are doing, there's healing work for some, but not for others. In a few books, you'll see spells or rituals that are geared towards companion animals. In a very rare case or two, you'll see that directed towards free living animals, or even, I was only actually able to find one witch who, she's an ex-vegan, Tess Whitehurst, who had some spells that were for animals in labs and slaughterhouses and such. But for the most part, they're not included at all. I think the silence there is very important. When there's silence, that means that they're not even worth, you know, acknowledgement. That is a very, that's a power flex. But there are cases where, yes, they explicitly say you don't fool with, for instance, cemetery magic. We were talking about that earlier. But so I think Rachel Patterson, I believe, is the name of the witch. I can't remember exactly what her name was. I think her last name was Patterson. But she was arguing that cemetery magic should not be done unless it's someone that you know and you ask permission and you don't fool with strangers' graves. That's just bad. But then later in the book, she's like, okay, so if you come across roadkill, then here's some ways that you can strip their bones and use the bones in the rituals. Or if you have your Sunday roast, you should save the bones from your Sunday roast. And here's some of the cool things you can do in your rituals. But it's like, whoa, 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 okay. So you have all these rules about going to cemeteries and, by the way, not even digging up human body parts. Just basically in modern witchcraft, when they do cemetery magic, it's usually just working with cemetery dirt. But then when it comes to non-human animals, oh, okay, well, let's just actually use their corpses. And what you see time and time again, and there, by the way, there's whole books on using dead animal bodies, horns and bones and skulls and all that kind of stuff. And they also explain how to take the flesh off, very Jeffrey Dahmer stuff. But what is very interesting about that is the rationale that they give, because they know that it's a bit contentious to work with dead bodies because it's stigmatized to work with dead bodies, animal bodies included, because yeah, Jeffrey Dahmer, one of the first things he did before he went off to start killing people, human being people, he was killing animal people. So witches know that there's a bit of a stigma there. But what they'll do to rationalize it, you see this over and over again, is they'll say, well, the animal would go to waste otherwise. And we're honoring the animal by using their bodies. So what? Okay. First off, it wouldn't go to waste. If an animal dies in the woods or is killed on the road, it wouldn't go to waste. They wouldn't go to waste. Other animals would, ants would eat them. It would move back into the dirt and it would go back into nature and have a perfectly good use in the ecosystem. It's not going to waste. When they're saying it's going to waste, it's like we aren't exploiting this animal to our full benefit. That's what they're saying. And they're using a capitalist framework. They may harken back to some indigenous stuff. Oh, indigenous people, which there's a lot of that romanticization of indigenous people by white witches, by the way, white raced witches. But this idea that, well, if we're not using it to its full capacity, then it's not morally good. Using the morality, the moral framework of capitalism, and putting it into witchcraft, which is really problematic. And a lot of modern witchcraft, by the way, is very critical of capitalism because it's nature-based and sustainable and all this sort of stuff. So when it comes to non-human animals, there remains this complete block about how non-human animals aren't objects that need to be exploited, resources that need to be made good on. They're persons. And if we want to respect human beings in cemeteries, why aren't we respecting non-human animals that we find dead or worse, that they're killing? So there's no honoring of the non-human animals when you're eating them just because it's for pleasure or whatever, and then you're flushing them down the toilet, down into the magical sewer system, like, okay, we'll do a little ritual over the toilet. Like, that's not happening. It's not honoring them.
Yeah, they're very true. Beautiful way to say it.
Oh, that's a toilet part.
No, it's a compelling argument, you know, taking the corpse of living beings and then, I'm sorry for my language, but shitting that being in the toilet, this is like peak.
We honor you.
Yes, I mean, this is a blasphemy and desecration of nature at the highest level. But, you know, I feel the same way about witches as I feel about Buddhists, in the sense that you would expect Buddhists and witches to be the first, you know, on the front line of defending animals and being vegan and all of that, but they're not. You know, the witches, you know, when I think about witches, I think about the familiars, I think about again the connection with nature, like you described very well in the book. And so, you know, it's like, for me, it's natural for them to be vegan, yet they're not.
And I think that's the ultimate, this is where I come back to with that we were talking about earlier, with the first book that I wrote on the rational approach to animal rights and how it's very critical of religion. Because at the end of the day, and Kim Socha, by the way, has written a whole book on atheism and animal rights, where she goes through all the different religions, Wicca and witchcraft included, and says why this is a problematic way of advocating for animal rights. And that's what it comes down to, because it's beyond religion. Religion is just used. It's another ideological framework, right? So we have to really get at the root of it. And this is where my feminism comes in. I think we need to be thinking intersectional. And if we're just relying on religion to kind of save us from oppression, I think historically religion, unfortunately, has just been another system of an ideological system. So I'm really hesitant to use it in that way. In the book, I'm hoping that witches will read that and say, okay, I do see power in nature and solidarity with other animals, and I don't want to participate in hurting them anymore. But on the other hand, I think probably more realistic, the outcome of this book is that I'm going to be encouraging more already vegan or people all sort of vegan, on the fence vegans, to think about how to use the power of witchcraft to help manage compassion fatigue and things like that, sadly.
Wonderful. So, Corey, I think we covered a lot.
Great conversation.
Yes.
Thought-provoking.
Did you want to add something before I stop the recording?
No, I guess, okay, how about this? For people who are like, what the hell is this woman talking about? You know what? I read the book or don't. But maybe if we can just take a moment and, where's the moon? Look for the moon. Check out the moon. Where's the sun? Where are we in the season right now? And even if you start to attune your body to your consciousness, to paying attention to where you are in the larger scheme of the seasonal changes and the cosmic changes, lunar phases, I think that you'll start to sense a bit of a change in your inner world. And you know, that's a good place to start.
Thank you for that. Yes, great advice. It's difficult to describe such, you know, profound practices and feelings. It takes away from them. But trust us and try it. And it's beyond words. So, yes. Corey, this has been a lovely conversation. Thank you so much for having answered my questions. Thank you so much for the book and for all that you do for the animals.
Thank you as well. It's not easy work what you do.
Thank you everyone for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.